Good evening. My name is Peter Berg, and as the host, I'd like to welcome you to another evening of the Michigan Writers Series. We're delighted that you're here this evening for our guest reader. The Michigan Writers Series, as always, is generously supported by Schuller's Books and Music, and you probably noticed that outside, Schuller's has made available copies of the book by tonight's author, and I'm sure that she'll be happy to sign any copies that you might purchase. I know I've already bought mine, and I'm ready to have her sign it after the reading. So we're delighted that you're here. We have other writers coming as part of the Michigan Writers Series, and the schedule is up here, and please take one of the schedules as you leave, and we'd love to see you for future events. We're very excited about the spring term and the readers that we have coming. Tonight's guest is Amy Hassinger. Hassinger's debut novel, Nina, Adolescence, tells the story of the creative and sexual awakening of 15-year-old Nina Begley as she struggles to emerge from her family's grief after the loss of her little brother. Deemed superb by O, the Oprah magazine, and truly penetrating by Salon.com, Nina, Adolescence will be released in paperback in June. The audio recording of Nina, Adolescence, received a Listen Up Award from Publishers Weekly in January 2004. Hassinger's work has also appeared in Blythe House Quarterly and Misfit magazine, and her story, La Llorona, will be anthologized in Best Lesbian Love Stories 2004 by Allison Publications. She has also written a history textbook for middle and high school students, Finding Katahdin, An Exploration of Maine's Past by the University of Maine Press, published in 2001. Her story, The Kiss, received the Peter S. Prescott Prize in 1994. Hassinger is a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, where she was awarded the Joseph E. and Ursel I. Callan Scholarship, as well as a Teaching Writing Fellowship. A Massachusetts native, Hassinger now lives in Okemos with her husband and daughter, and is at work on her second novel, which will also be published by Putnam Press. Please join me in welcoming Amy Hassinger.
Hi, thanks so much for coming. It's great to see you all here. I thought I'd start by actually reading from the anthology Best Lesbian Love Stories, which is out now, I believe. At least I have my copy. And the story that I have published in here, La Llorona, it was actually the genesis of this book, Nina Adolescence. And people often ask, you know, where'd you get your ideas? And so I thought it might be sort of interesting for you to hear just a little piece of the story that I worked from. I think that this story is about a character named Nina, but I think of her as being very different from the Nina that appears in Nina Adolescence. But in any case, just to give you a feel. And I'll just read the first couple pages of La Llorona. In a small pocket of the city, where imported palm trees lined the sidewalks, where tiny backyards of plum and lemon trees and occasional swatches of green lawn were framed by steep wooden staircases, where old Victorians stood in various stages of disrepair against the clear sky, painted brightly in pinks, blues, and purples, there was heard every morning at the rising of the sun a wail. This wail keened out over a small courtyard, waking the inhabitants of the apartments that surrounded it. It began like the whistle of a tea kettle, a thin ribbon of sound that grew broader, heightening until it became a wide, wavering vibrato, a careening sheet of noise, a bright flag flapping in a gale. Immediately, the Colombian construction worker in the shotgun two-bedroom on the third floor rolled over and stretched himself out of bed. His wife groaned and sat up next to him, listening for their son. The newlywed computer programmers, whose bedroom windows overlooked the courtyard, snuggled tightly for just a few minutes more before they rose and jumped in the shower together. The waitress in the first floor apartment who worked the night shift finished her cigarette and took a last bite of her sandwich before tucking herself in for the morning. The earnest young yoga teacher went to stand by his kitchen window, sipping his green tea, and gazed toward what he thought might be the source of the sound, hoping to catch just a glimpse of the wailing woman. Though he tried, he could not identify the source of the cry. It seemed to come from all around, to bounce off his walls and high Edwardian ceilings, and to hang in the air like the fog shrouding the twin peaks above. Poor lady, thought the Colombian woman as she fixed an egg for her son's breakfast. She's been abandoned by her lover, left to care for her infant child alone. The woman's overworked, thought the waitress who worked the night shift as she fell into bed and closed her eyes, with feet she can't stand to lift. I bet she's a crazy old hag with a hunchback, said the computer programmer through a mouthful of toothpaste, who can hardly stand up. His new wife laced her hands around his waist. With sunken eyes, she said, and just one or two yellowed teeth. Oh, how lonely she must be, thought the earnest young yoga teacher. How desperate, how empty. No single story was approved by the neighborhood as a cause for the wail, but they did latch on to a name. The professor of Chicano studies who lived two floors below the yoga teacher dubbed her La Llorona, the wailing woman. As she told it, there's a Mexican legend about a wailing woman, La Llorona se llama. She bore children she didn't want, and she drowned them in the river. But she was haunted by her crime, and now she wanders the streets at night, weeping for her dead babies. She dresses all in white like a ghost, and if you look at her face, you will die. This woman wails like her. She dropped her voice to a whisper. I think she's done something terrible. Hay maldad en su casa. Nina's view of herself was not quite so mythic. She led a balanced life. She ate well, a bowl full of oatmeal cooked with apples and raisins for breakfast, a salad at lunch, and a good balance of protein, complex carbohydrates, and vegetables at dinner. She arrived at 8 o'clock sharp every morning at her office downtown. She worked as a paralegal at Pearson, Ricker & Storrs, a corporate law firm. And she arranged her lunch in the staff refrigerator and attached the wrist cushion to the base of her computer keyboard. She stood up to stretch her wrists, back, and shoulders every hour and a half to minimize the chances of developing carpal tunnel syndrome. Every evening after work, she set the Stairmaster at the Wellness Center for 25 minutes on interval training, then took her pulse as she walked to cool down, a consistent 115 at the end of her workout, 75 when resting. She was fit, trim, wore sneakers to work, and took public transportation as much as possible, and drank only one glass of wine a week with her dinner on Friday nights to cut down on the risk of heart disease and help her sleep. Every morning, Nina rose at 5:45, wrapped herself in a silver silk robe her mother had given her when she was still alive, shuffled into the kitchen to put on the coffee, stretched her back and hamstrings in four sun salutes, and stepped into the shower. As the water hit her face, wetting her short blonde bob and her upturned nose, she stretched her mouth wide, stuck out her tongue as far as she could, opened her throat, and said what she thought was, "Ah." This yoga pose was called the lion's roar, and its purpose was to stretch and strengthen the tongue, lips, throat, and vocal cords, as well as to greet the day. Nina believed this "ah" was nothing more than an extended guttural sigh. She was not aware of the way the sound, once given the opportunity to escape, surged from her like a great freshet breaking a dam. So that's the beginning of La Llorona. And you can see what you think if there's any resemblance to the Nina in here. This book begins with a prologue, which I'm not going to read. Because it's really too sad. But I'll start with the first chapter. And I just wanted to read a little bit here and there to give you an idea of each of the main characters in the book. So what you should know as far as what happens in the prologue is that Nina's brother, Nina's younger brother, Jonas, who is 4 at the time, dies in the prologue. He drowns in their backyard pond under Nina's supervision. She's 11. At the time, and watching him while their mother's just inside on the phone. And that's clearly the main event of the prologue. So I'll get into the first chapter, which begins, as the first three words say, 4 years later. 4 years later, Nina stood naked on a platform in her mother's attic studio, feeling the August heat rising through the floorboards. They had opened the windows and the door and set a fan up in the back window, the one that looked onto the backyard, the pond, and the woods beyond, in an attempt to draw the sultry air out and the fresh air in. On cooler days, Nina liked listening to the street sounds that floated through the high round window on the north wall, the pounding feet of children, a car slowing to pull into a driveway, a distant mockingbird. But today these sounds were eclipsed by the fan's hypnotic hum, and still the air felt motionless. If there was a breeze, she didn't feel it. She stood on a green cotton blanket, an approximation of grass, that covered the wooden platform. Her hair fell limp around her face and clung to her neck. Rivulets of sweat dripped from the wet tendrils of hair at her throat and snaked down her sternum, feeding into the larger river that ran down the center of her chest to her belly. She fixed her gaze directly at her mother as if confronting her. She had been posing for close to 3 hours and her feet hurt. Pain twinged in her lower back. "Can I take a break, Mom?" she asked. "Just give me another minute." Her mother was thrusting paint at the canvas in short, panicked strokes, as if the canvas were attacking her. Her gaze flitted quickly from the painting to Nina and back again. They had begun this painting just a few days ago. It was the largest canvas her mother had used so far, out of the 30-some portraits she'd completed of Nina since Jonas had died. They were preparing for a show, her mother's first since the accident, at Pearson's Gallery in Boston. It opened in a month. Jim Pearson had been urging Marion to show her latest work for over a year, and finally she had agreed. She would hang a selection of paintings from the Nina series, all of Nina, all nudes. Lately, her mother had become more and more panicked about the show, insisting on more time from Nina in the studio. This summer alone, she had begun 5 new paintings and only finished one of them. Nina had tried to tell her she had more than enough paintings to choose from, but she didn't listen. "This new painting was essential," she said. She needed something recent to complete the series, something big and ambitious, something more imaginative, more provocative, something important. Her mother groaned. "Ugh, what shit, what utter shit," she muttered. She swiveled her chair to her work table, an old oak door laid across 2 sawhorses, and reached for a few tubes of paint. She squirted snakes of color onto the slab of glass that she used as a palette, then worked the colors into each other with her palette knife until she seemed satisfied. Loading her brush with paint, she turned back to the canvas, where she began to jab the new color at the surface again. Her mother had first told Nina about the show 3 months ago, when September had seemed ages away. That was June, when the days were lengthening and the whole summer stretched ahead of her like a lush, hilly landscape. There had been so much to look forward to, long days of reading on the back deck, afternoons exploring in the woods, evening walks with her father to the ice cream parlor in town, dance camp in July, and then their trip to Maine the first week of August. It had been easy to agree to the show, to be excited for her mother, entering the art world once again after such a long hiatus. Once school let out, she posed a little bit every day, an hour at most, and spent the time imagining, executing perfect arabesques in her mind, leg raised almost to her head, foot arched like a crescent moon, or dreaming up best friends and sophisticated conversations. All summer long, she had ignored the show, even forgotten about it. Now it was upon her. Her mother worried about it daily. She kept Nina in the studio for longer and longer hours, occasionally for whole days. As Marion's anxiety increased, so did Nina's. Instead of choreographing dances in her mind, she imagined the stark white walls of Pearson's gallery and the paintings hanging there under the bright lighting, her own naked body reproduced again and again. It made her queasy. Her stomach growled loudly. She cleared her throat and watched the condensation drip down the sides of the glass water pitcher that stood on her mother's work table. She felt as if she were standing in the middle of a cloud of breath, someone's damp exhalation. The sound of the fan buzzed in her ears, and as she listened, it seemed to grow louder and louder, crescendoing until she could almost feel her eardrums vibrating with its buzz. She tried to focus on her mother's shape, on the plain pine crossbars of the easel, but her vision blurred and an image materialized in place of sight, an expanse of endless white sand, pristine desert stretching toward a horizon. She tried to breathe deeply, but there was something pressing against her lungs. I'm dissolving, she thought, as the buzzing grew even louder, as the white desert sand sent up waves of heat and the blankness spread all around her. A moment later, she woke on her back with a wet face and her mother sitting beside her holding the empty water pitcher. God almighty, her mother said, you scared the shit out of me. Are you all right? She sat up, her head spinning. She nodded. Here, drink this. Her mother offered her a glass of water. Nina sipped. Jesus, you feel okay? Say something. Yeah, I'm fine. I guess I just got too hot. All right, well, let's quit. She placed a sweaty hand against Nina's forehead. Here, can you stand? She offered Nina her hand. Nina stood. Sorry, she said. No, that's all right. Not your fault. There was a knock on the door jamb. Shit, her mother whispered. You guys going to eat? Her father asked. He remained carefully out of sight. He knew Nina was probably still undressed. Dinner's about done. Nina stepped off the platform and reached for her clothes. I'll be down in a minute, Dad. Marion? I don't know. I need to work on the background here. Okie doke, her father said. His feet fell softly on the stairs. Nina pulled her jeans over her hips and buttoned the fly. You should eat something, Mom, she said. You didn't have any lunch. I know. Marion sighed again and turned back to the painting. This is such utter shit. Can I take a look? No, not yet, not yet. Her mother stared at the painting. Nina went to the studio door. You're sure you're all right? Asked her mother. Yeah, fine. I probably just got dehydrated. Don't tell your father, okay? I won't. Her mother smiled. Come here, sweetheart. She walked toward her, arms outstretched. Nina obliged, stepping into the hug, resting her face against her mother's shoulder. Her skin was sticky. You know how grateful I am, don't you? Her lips moved against Nina's scalp. Yes, she said. I don't know what I'd do without you, honey. You know that. Yes, Mom. She stared at the drop cloth that partially covered the floor. She still felt dizzy and needed to get out of the studio, away from that buzzing fan, from the close stink of her mother's sweat. She straightened her back and her mother released her. Go on, she said. I'll be down soon. Okay, so it's funny reading this after so long because you start to notice sentences that shouldn't be there. I feel like I should have a pen here. That doesn't work. So the next section I'll read is to give you a sense of Nina's friend Raisa, who she meets at her ballet class. And this is very soon after she's met Raisa. The school year has just begun, and they're just starting to become friends. They began walking to ballet class together after school. Nina met Raisa at her locker, where she was usually sorting loose papers and stuffing unneeded ones into the growing pile at the bottom of the locker. Nina would lean against the other lockers and wait, usually 10 or more minutes, for Raisa to assemble the contents of her book bag. On the way to town, they passed the soccer field, and they would stop sometimes and watch the drills, boys dribbling balls around orange traffic cones or lining up to shoot on goal. The soccer coach was Raisa's math teacher, Mr. Meyer. He must have been close to 50. His brown hair was peppered with gray, and his cheeks were loosening. But he moved easily like a 20-year-old, and he had electric blue eyes. Raisa always had a new story about the latest girl that had made a fool of herself over him in math class. Nancy Goldberg was wearing the lowest cut shirt she had ever seen, and when they were working on problems, she went up to Mr. Meyer's desk and leaned over it with her paper, and you could see everything. Or Susan Marks, who had terrible acne, embarrassed herself by staring at Mr. Meyer so obviously when she was supposed to be working on a test that Mr. Meyer had to ask her if she had a question, and her whole face turned even redder than her zits. Mr. Meyer, according to Raisa, loved the attention. He chatted with Nancy and the other popular girls in the class and joked with them about drinking games and ski trips. And he always had that smirk on his face that had nothing to do with parabolic functions. I bet he and Nancy sleep together, Raisa said. I bet they do it in his car. They strolled toward the art center, sometimes stopping for a snack at Kentucky Fried Chicken or the corner bakery. As they walked, Raisa chatted steadily about whatever came to mind. Her favorite musicals, number one, Jesus Christ Superstar, number two, Anything Goes, Indian food, which she loved, Ethiopian food, which she hated, The injustice done to animals at the aquarium and the zoo, grave rubbings, her parents' divorce, Kahlua and cream, her favorite drink, The Great Gatsby, her favorite book within the past year, silk versus polyester, the injustice done to political prisoners in Chile and Argentina, the most effective technique to use when apple picking, being pro-choice, her favorite kind of incense, jasmine, and her least favorite, sandalwood, or her favorite Alfred Hitchcock films, Rear Window and Vertigo. Nina listened and laughed. Sometimes Raisa asked her what her own favorites were, but Nina usually felt that she didn't really have a favorite, per se. There were books and movies she liked, and a few stood out in her mind, but her feelings about them were never as strong as Raisa's. You must have a favorite, Raisa would say, disappointed, so Nina might choose one to appease her. Mainly, she was happy to listen to Raisa talk. Once they arrived at the studio, though, it was Nina's turn to talk. She demonstrated her stretches for Raisa, who tried to imitate them with varying degrees of success. She showed her how to lean into each stretch slowly, without bouncing, how to let the muscles warm and elongate. Listen to your body, she coached, repeating Mrs. Dubois' words. That's her ballet teacher, Mrs. Dubois. Don't push yourself. At the bar, Nina taught Raisa to turn out from her hips, not her feet, and to keep it modest so as not to hurt her knees. She explained that the spine was her core, that each vertebra should perch lightly on top of the one beneath it, and that when she plied, which Nina demonstrated, the top of her head should reach toward the ceiling, even as her body descended. The dance studio was Nina's territory. It was the single place where Nina felt she had something to teach. This pattern continued for a couple of weeks until, after some anxious deliberation, Nina decided to invite Raisa over. She chose an afternoon when her mother would be out at a meeting with Jim Pearson to finalize details for the show. Nina made herself ask Raisa before she had the chance to get nervous about it while they were walking to the dance center, and she kept her face turned to the side so she didn't have to look Raisa in the eye. It was surprisingly easy. Raisa said she'd come and went on talking as if it was no big deal. They rode the bus home together the next day. Nina was quiet during the ride. She was hoping the house wasn't too messy, hoping Raisa couldn't hear her heart thrumming through her t-shirt. They got off at her stop and walked the few blocks to her house. As Nina opened the front door, she got a whiff of dust. The wooden stair railing looked grimy with hand grease, and she could see bands of black dirt along its grain. Paint was peeling from the radiator in the corner. Dust had settled on the windowsills. A spider web hung from the branches of the ficus plant, whose leaves were coated with dust. It was worse than she thought. She looked anxiously at Raisa. But Raisa seemed not to notice. She walked straight to the portrait that hung on the wall by the stairs. It was of Nina's father when he was young, his chest bare, his skin a luminous white over his jeans. He was watching an unseen vista. Nina liked the painting because he looked so young. He was thinner and beardless, and he appeared to be dreaming. Excuse me. Who's this? Raisa asked. My dad. Stepping closer to the painting, she noticed dust here, too, lining the gilded florets of the frame and speckled across the impasto. It's at Mount Monadnock. Who painted it? Raisa asked. Nina hesitated. My mom did, actually. Really? She seemed impressed. This is really good. She's an artist. You never told me that. Nina smiled. Does she only do portraits? Mainly some still lifes, realistic stuff. Does she do nudes? Raisa asked, drawing out the U in nude. Yeah. My mom once took this art class at Smith where she had to paint nudes. I had to meet her there once, and I remember I walked in and there was this guy standing totally naked in front of a room full of college girls and my mom. They were all pretending like he was just a statue or something. I had to leave the room, I was laughing so hard. Artists paint nudes all the time, Nina said, feeling defensive. So is your mom famous? No, not really. She has a gallery that represents her, though. Are there more paintings around? Raisa asked, wandering through the hall toward the studio, toward the kitchen. Only upstairs in her studio. Raisa swung around quickly. She has a studio here? Can we go see it? She doesn't really like anyone to go in there. How will she know? She'll know. Raisa rolled her eyes. Let's eat something, Nina said quickly. I'm starving. She led Raisa to the kitchen. She was relieved to see that there was only a glass and a crumb-covered plate in the sink, and that the table had only a few torn envelopes on it. Normally, the kitchen table was like a relief map of their lives, a topography of papers and old magazines, burnt crusts, coins, folded cards, and half-empty glasses of orange juice from that morning's breakfast, or even some breakfast earlier that week. Thankfully, her father must have done some tidying. She opened the refrigerator and faced an array of suddenly unfamiliar food. Dozens of plastic containers seemed to have materialized on the shelves, along with foreign jars of orange chutneys and ancient hot sauces. There was a jar of candied hazelnuts crusted with caramelized syrup, a Tupperware bowl containing 7 thawed green beans, and another with fat noodles suspended in cloudy brown liquid. She wished she had something normal to offer Raisa: potato chips and sour cream dip, orange soda, Girl Scout cookies. She took out a loaf of bread and the butter dish. "There's fruit," she said, pointing to the bowl on the counter. Raisa asked for peanut butter and peeled a banana. They sat down at the table with their food and ate in silence for a few minutes. Nina bit into a plum and juice dribbled over her lip onto her chin. Giggling, she reached for her napkin. Raisa took a spoonful of peanut butter from the jar and licked it from the spoon. She tapped Nina on the shoulder and opened her mouth. "Ah," she said, sticking out her tongue. That's familiar, isn't it? Something with tongues and ah. "Gross, it's white." "My tongue? The peanut butter, it turns white in your mouth." "Let me see yours," said Raisa. She stuck out her tongue. "Eh, boring, just orange plum guts." "Your tongue is weird, though. Stick it out as far as you can." She stretched her tongue from its base, reaching for the tip of her nose. "Farther." "I can't," she said, her tongue still protruding from her mouth, so her syllables came out sounding like, "Aha," with a tone of protest. "Your tongue is so small, it's like a mini tongue." "It is not." "It is, look at mine." Raisa extended her tongue over her large lip, spreading it wide. She touched the tip of her nose with it easily, tongue to spare. "See, mine is much longer than yours." "Well, la-di-da," Nina said. "I know, let's see how far apart our heads have to be to touch tongues." "Gross." "Come on, just try it, just to see." Raisa pulled her chair closer to Nina and stuck out her tongue. Reluctantly, Nina put out hers. She looked at it over the shadowy hump of her nose. The tip of it was almost pointy. Raisa moved her head closer, and Nina moved forward carefully, keeping her eyes on the space between their tongues as it grew narrower. Finally, they touched. She felt wet, soft flesh, tasted peanuts. She yelped and scooted her chair backward. They both laughed and wiped their mouths. Nina ran to the sink and put her mouth under the faucet, letting the cold water run over her chin, down her neck. "Blech," she shouted, laughing. "That was so weird." Raisa nodded. "It was like Frenching a frog or something, like the Frog Prince." This sent them both into another fit of laughter. Eventually, after their hysteria expired and they had begun eating again, Nina asked a question. "Have you ever Frenched anyone?" "Of course, haven't you?" Nina hesitated a moment before admitting, "No." "Really? Well, you haven't missed much." "Who did you?" "Oh, God, promise not to tell anyone." Nina made the sign of a cross over her heart and nodded. "My cousin." "You Frenched your cousin? That's like incest." "Not really. He's my second or third cousin or something. It was weird, though. They were visiting us for Christmas one year. It was snowing, and Vlad said he could teach me to make an igloo. He's 3 years older than me. So we went out in the backyard and made an igloo, which is not really a real igloo, but more like a snow fort. And then we went inside it, and Vlad said that Eskimos took their clothes off in igloos because they were so warm. I said, yeah, right. How do you think they do it, he said. Do what, I said. I was still kind of naive because I was in fifth grade. Anyway, he said, it, you know, sex. And I was totally shocked and didn't say anything. And then he kissed me. Just like that? He didn't even ask you or anything? Nope, he just forced his tongue in my mouth and moved it around. Did you kiss him back? I guess I did, yeah. She seemed amused at herself. Did you do anything else? Oh, he touched my boob and then my mom called us in for lunch. Really? Excuse me. I remember his face when he heard my mom's voice. It was so funny, he freaked. He jumped up and knocked a hole through the snow fort with his head. Did your parents find out? Are you kidding? We would have been in serious trouble. What did it feel like? Disgusting, but he was a bad kisser. I Frenched with someone else when I was in eighth grade. That was a lot better. Who? Raisa smiled. I'm not telling. Nina protested. Come on, I won't tell anyone, I promise. Nope. Why won't you tell me? Just 'cause. Is it someone I know? Is that why? How would it be someone you know? I didn't even live here. Come on, Raisa, tell me, she pleaded, feeling hurt. Let's go see your mother's studio, said Raisa. Don't try to change the subject. Nina, she said, now in a serious tone, I'm not going to tell you right now, so just stop asking. It's nothing personal, okay? Nina sighed. Fine, she muttered. Come on, said Raisa, standing up and offering Nina her hand. I want to go see your mom's paintings. No, I don't think we should. What are you so worried about? We'll just be up there a second. She'll never know. It's not just that, Nina said, but Raisa, an impish look in her eye, ran quickly toward the staircase and began to climb. Raisa, Nina shouted. She leapt from her chair, spilling a glass of juice. The cup knocked to the floor behind her. Wait! I'll leave you in suspense there. This next section happens at the art opening, and it's toward the end of the evening. And Nina has gotten bored, and so she's gone into the office of the gallery and called Raisa. And she's now coming out of the office to ask her father and mother if she can go sleep at Raisa's house that night. When she neared them, her mother waved her over. Darling, she said, all sweetness, this is Mr. Leo Beck. He's the Boston correspondent for Art Today. Leo, my daughter, Nina. The man took her hand and squeezed it between his two. His palms were dry and smooth. A pleasure, Nina. Your mother and I are old friends. Nice to meet you, she said. He held her hand a moment longer than she thought necessary. You're to be congratulated as well for this fabulous show. I know the kind of work it takes to sit, especially for a perfectionist like Marion. Her mother laughed self-consciously. You two have done something beautiful here, truly. Leo Beck continued to study her. His eyes were a deep blue behind his glasses, and his lashes were long and black, almost like a child's. His skin was tanned and appeared rough, the cheeks pocked with acne scars. Her mother beamed and touched Leo's arm. That means a great deal to me, Leo, she said, to both of us. Her voice quavered, and Nina thought for a terrible moment that she might burst into tears. Dad, Nina began, hoping to ask her father about going to Raisa's and then escape to the office again. Can I? I was just saying to your mother, Leo interrupted, that I see an interesting story here. Nina widened her eyes politely at him, waiting for him to finish. He wants to do a feature on us, honey, her mother said, grabbing Nina's arm and pulling her close. He wants to do an interview. She kissed her on the forehead. Nina stifled an urge to wipe it off. Only if you're up for it, her father said. Why? Nina asked. Why what? Said her mother. Why do you want to interview both of us? Her mother laughed again, too loudly, and said, Nina, in a high voice, half scolding, half flirtatious, as if the question were too absurd to be asked. Leo looked amused. Well, there aren't too many mother-daughter pairs like you two around. Of course, plenty of painters have painted their children, but I don't know of many who have been as thorough, shall we say, as Marion. I think it would interest people to hear about how you work, to get the perspective from both sides of the canvas, as it were. He smiled. The skin at his temples crinkled. Nina shrugged. It's fine with me if Mom wants to do it. Of course, it'll be a blast, she said, as if they were discussing an afternoon at the beach, as if this weren't the very thing she had dreamed about for years. Good, how's Wednesday afternoon? I have dance, Mom, Nina said. Oh, you can skip it for once, honey. Marion, her father began in a warning tone, but his voice was drowned out by Leo's. I should have guessed you were a dancer, Leo said. You have a dancer's body. I skipped it today, Nina said to her mother, pretending she hadn't heard Leo's comment. The smile had dropped from her father's face. Nina, if Wednesday is the best day for Leo, her mother began. Marion, her father jumped in again, his voice stronger this time. Nina has her own obligations to meet. Exactly, Leo said. Whenever's convenient. I don't want to throw anyone's schedule off. Monday's the only day I don't have it, Nina said. Monday it is then, Leo declared. He slipped a thin book and a pen from the inner pocket of his sport coat and recorded the date. Monday at 3? Perfect, her mother said. Should we meet you at your office? I'll come your way. That way I can take a look at the studio, if that's all right, get a feel for the workspace. He smiled again. He had a nice smile, full lips, extra white teeth, and his eyes were so blue, almost turquoise it seemed, like a tropical ocean. He turned suddenly to Nina, who blushed. He had caught her staring. I was just, you're a photographer, she asked, stumbling over her words. Leo patted his chest. Am I wearing a badge? How'd you know that? I was just looking at some slides in Jim's office. I saw your name. What do you know? I can't believe he still has those hanging around. They're ancient. Leo used to show in this gallery, Nina, her mother said. She rested her hand on Leo's wrist as she spoke. It's how we met, actually, remember? Of course, Jim and I were hashing something out, and you came in one day, soaked to the bone from the rain. Her mother giggled. Oh, I was young then, she said. Her eyes danced, and for a moment, Nina thought she could see a younger self emerging, a woman who was more buoyant and daring, a woman who had never experienced grief. Her mother looked at Leo another moment before she wiped a finger beneath both eyes and cleared her throat. God, she said, I'm losing it. Never grow as old as me, Leo. You start to lose your mind. It's inevitable. Oh, now, Leo said, you don't look a day over 30. Ha! What a flatterer. Nina, her father broke in loudly. Come with me. I want to introduce you to someone. Great to meet you, Nina, Leo said as they left. Nice to see you again, Henry. Her father's smile looked like a wince. They maneuvered through the crowd back to the hors d'oeuvres table, where her father refilled his glass and placed a few canapes and some cheese on his napkin. Dad, can I sleep over at Raisa's house tonight? Nina asked, stealing one of his canapes. Raisa? He asked, distractedly. My friend from dance, please? I don't see why not. He took a large drink from his glass and sighed. I'd like to get the hell out of here. How much time do we have left? He asked, glancing at the clock on the wall. Not too long, half an hour, she said. Half an hour of Chinese water torture is enough to drive a person mad. Who did you want me to meet? Huh? Oh. He picked a piece of cheese up from his napkin and held it out to her. My dear friend, Shelley Cheddar, meet my daughter, Nina. Nina, Shelley. Shelley's quite a whiz with a cracker. Dad, she said teasingly and grabbed for the cheese. Hey, he said, playfully slapping her hand away. Friends are hard to come by around here. Get your own. Nina stopped at the table on her way back to the office to call Raisa and loaded a napkin with three cubes of cheese, two canapes, a stuffed mushroom, and a piece of cauliflower with dip. She was ravenous. Her nervousness had left her, and she no longer felt queasy. The show was almost over. The crowd was thinning out. It had been awkward, but she had survived it. Her mother was being a flirt, and she felt badly for her father, but it seemed like a minor offense. Her mother might have gotten her best break yet. Why shouldn't she be giddy? And best of all, Raisa and she were friends again. She put a piece of cheese in her mouth as she headed for the office door. At a touch on her elbow, she swiveled to face Leo Beck. He took her hand again, his palm smooth, and his thumb traveled across her skin. I'm taking off, Nina, he said. It was great to meet you. He leaned toward her as if to kiss her cheek, and his lips brushed her ear. You're gorgeous, he whispered. His jacket swung behind him as he left. She stood watching, her mouth closed around the still unchewed piece of cheese. Okay. I think I'll leave you with that for this book. but I did want to read a little bit from what I'm working on right now. just because, you know, by the time a book comes out, you're sort of moved on and your head is someplace else entirely. And this is, I wanted to give you an idea of where my head is right now. So this book, it won't be out for a while. It probably won't be out until the summer of 2005. Right now, the working title is The Priest's Madonna. And this, I'm going to read you just the first few chapters of, the first few pages of chapter one. So I won't go into a whole long explanation of the story. But I will explain, one, that one of the main characters in the book is just goes by an initial, the letter B. So when you hear me say B, that's who I'm talking about. It's not B-E-A as a woman's name. It's a man. And then this book is set in France, in the south of France. So there are several French terms which I may mispronounce, so I will do my best to do a good job. And, you know, I'll read it with the caveat that it is a work in progress, so who knows if it'll actually end up in the final book or not. But you get a sneak preview. Decay is all around me. It always has been, I realize. Only in the past, I used to battle it with broom and mop, dust rag and polish, whereas now I allow it to spread, relentless, to invade the presbytery and the villa, the church and the gardens. I rarely visit the villa. The smell of the moldering curtains assaults my nostrils when I open the door, and I am reminded of the rascal Germans who used them to wipe the mud from their boots, only last year, or perhaps the year before. The curtains were a bold crimson brocade when they first arrived. I still remember the tang of the fabric when I opened the box, their slippery weight as I unfolded them. Now they are faded, frayed, and stained. The wallpaper, decorated with a tropical print I had hoped would evoke the Amazon, is smudged with soot and pocked with holes from the Germans' darts. Shards of ceramic from Bee's Florentine vases still crunch underfoot when I walk near the fountain, where the soldiers set them up for target practice. The windows in the orangery have all burst, though I can't blame that on the Germans, only on the wind. The orange trees that Bee tended so lovingly have long ago withered and died. Even the library I so prized, that Bee began and that Madame finished with her generous endowment, even that is gone now, its contents looted not only by the many curious and unscrupulous travelers that have passed through these grounds, but also by me in recent years. I've given the books away to anyone who asks, the older children in the village mainly, those who are interested in travel and the world beyond our hill. Books, once my saviors, things I revered with the kind of veneration particular to the self-educated, give me only meager pleasure now. What good is knowledge in the face of nihilism? A book cannot halt an army. I spend my days now musing. I still find it strange, after all these many years, the choices I've made, the ways in which, with each one, I complicated the weave of my own peculiar tapestry. Now that I am old, I no longer believe in fate. It is tempting to look back at the unfolding of my days and call them fated, to see their succession as the fulfillment of a design woven by skilled unseen hands. But I have lived 80 years. I have seen the cruel banality of war. I have witnessed the many deaths and births that forge a life. And I know now about that more mercurial spinner we call chance. Still, if I try to identify the first moment I took the weft in my hands, I think about when I first met Bee in the grotto at St. Baume, before either of us was aware of the intimate tangle our lives would become. It was the eve of St. Madeleine's feast day, July 21st, 1877. We had come from all corners of the country, Bourgogne, Limousin, Bretagne, even some from Paris. My mother was pregnant with poor Christophe, though it was early enough in the pregnancy that I knew nothing of it. I imagine she wanted to come to Saint-Baume to receive the blessing of Marie-Madeleine before his birth. The trip to Saint-Baume was long. We rode by train to the coast, where we caught a ferry to Marseille. The boat was full. It was difficult to find seats as we arrived late, and I saw faces of all sorts, the ruddy, wind-scoured cheeks of old farmers, gentlemen of my father's age, sharply dressed, young children, brows smudged with dirt, older girls in fresh pinafores, hair prettily braided, and some young men who gathered in groups to play cards and smoke. But mainly I saw women of my mother's age, some with children, some without, and though they all wore their differences plainly on their faces and in their clothing, they bore themselves with a similar hopeful and anticipatory air. Though the train ride, our first, the railroad had only just come to our town at the beginning of the month, had been thrilling, it had been unbearably hot. We had been sitting across from an unpleasant woman and her two equally unpleasant sons, who entertained themselves by thinking up cruel names to call my five-year-old brother Claude, and so I was glad to be on board the ferry and to feel the wind off the Mediterranean. I was 9 and curious about most things. My mother allowed me to roam the decks of the ferry as long as I brought Claude along and reported to her from time to time, and I was pleased with this arrangement. We explored all 3 decks thoroughly, it being the first time either of us had set foot on a boat, and after we had observed that each deck generally resembled the other, with some differences in the arrangement of seats and the location of the stairs, we stationed ourselves on the top deck to watch the sea boil in our wake. Gulls flew overhead, crying in their mournful way. We found an abandoned crust of bread and tore pieces from it, which we set on the railings for the gulls, who lit briefly and took off again, the morsels caught in their beaks. It was then that I first noticed him. I glanced over to where my mother stood and saw her chatting with a well-dressed young man. Even from that distance, his dark brows and broad forehead were striking, or so I imagine, though perhaps this is a trick of the memory. But being 9 and unconcerned with adult affairs, I turned away after a moment and thought no more of it. We arrived at Marseille as evening was coming on. As we had a good hike in front of us, Mother took us to a cafe to have a drink and a bit of bread and cheese before we started out. There was another family at the cafe, a young couple with a little girl, who were also planning to go to the midnight mass at Saint-Baume, and so we sat with them and chatted while we ate our supper. The little girl took a liking to Claude and repeatedly kissed him on the cheek, which made all of us laugh. By the time we set out on our hike, the day had cooled, which we were thankful for because it was a steep climb and we were tired. The little girl complained most of the way up and finally had to be carried by her father up the final ascent to the grotto. There were fewer people at the grotto itself. Most contented themselves with attending the festival in town the next day. But when we arrived, the small cave was already mostly filled. We found a place toward the back. It was damp and cool despite the press of bodies. The little girl had fallen asleep on her father's shoulder. I found a stone to squat on while we waited for the mass to begin, and Claude rested his head in my lap. I stroked his hair and watched the sky darken to black and the stars begin to appear. The cool air and Claude's soft hair were pleasant, and my anticipation steadily grew as the time for the mass neared. It seemed clear to me that if so many people had traveled so far to attend this mass, then it would surely be magnificent. "What do you see, Maman?" I asked my mother, who stood beside me. "Nothing yet. It's dark." She placed her hand on my head. I must have dozed because I remember my mother rousing me excitedly, and I opened my eyes to see the cave lit by warm, trembling candlelight. Claude had left my lap and was now sleeping at Mother's feet, his head resting on her coat, which she had removed and bundled into a cushion. I stood straining to see over the heads of the crowd. I was too short, and I whispered to my mother to ask her what was happening, but she shushed me. Then the man in front of me turned around, and I saw that it was the same young man who had been speaking with my mother on the ferry earlier that day. "Do you want to see?" he asked. I nodded silently, embarrassed at having had my whisper detected. To my amazement, he squatted in the dirt in front of me and bowed his head. "Climb on my back," he said. I looked up to my mother for her approval, but she was immersed in the service and did not respond to my gaze. The young man was smiling broadly at me, clearly amused by the shock he must have seen in my eyes. To be carried on the back of a strange man, it was unconventional to say the least and probably unwise. But he didn't take notice. In fact, he seemed to gain a certain pleasure from the scandalous nature of his suggestion. "You've come all this way," he said. "You shouldn't miss it." Glancing at my mother once more and receiving no signal from her, I decided to follow his instructions. I lifted my skirt slightly, then grabbed hold of his shoulders and wrapped my legs around his back. He stood, grasping the undersides of my knees to steady me. My mother turned then, undoubtedly startled by the sudden movement at the periphery of her vision, and I can say that I have never seen her look, had never seen her look more horrified. "Marie," she said loudly, causing Claude to wake up and several people to turn their heads. My face burned, and I pushed against the young man's back, hoping he would drop me so I could escape the gaze of all those people, most especially my mother. But he spoke to her in our native patois and told her it was all right. He had urged me to do it, that it would be a shame for me to have come all this way and not be able to see the sainted Madeleine herself, as all these people were here to do. To my surprise, my mother's face softened, and she assented. "I suppose you're right," she responded, also in patois, and then turned back to the mass. From my new position, I saw that the lit grotto was more spectacular than I had imagined. It extended before us a few dozen yards. Votive candles had been placed in niches in the rock, as well as given to the people at the front of the congregation, so that the cave brightened as it deepened. The priest was surrounded by light as bright as day, and when he held up his hands to consecrate the bread and the wine, his palms shone like polished marble. Light reflected off the faces of the gathered congregation, some of which I remembered seeing on the ferry earlier that day. There, these same faces had been mundane, but here they glowed. As the priest bent to sip the wine, I noticed the reliquary behind him, a golden head borne on a miniature palanquin. Inside that reliquary was the skull of Marie Madeleine herself, the woman whom Christ had loved so dearly as to appear to her first and exhort her to spread the word of his resurrection to his disciples. I knew her then as the repentant sinner, the converted prostitute, fallible, faithful, devoted. I had read in my Lives of the Saints that she had come from France, she had come to France from Palestine in an oarless boat, put to sea by unbelievers who intended for her to drown, that she helped spread Christianity in Gaul, and that she spent the last 30 days of her life in this very cave, praying to the Lord she so loved in life. Here I was then in her hermitage, enclosed by the very walls she had gazed upon for so many hours. I felt suddenly lightheaded, and afraid I might topple backwards, tightened my grasp around my young man's neck. Remember, please, that I was young and overly sentimental. When it came time for communion, my young man set me down on the ground again so that he could join the orderly line that had formed down the center of the grotto. As he did not return to his original spot, I saw no more of him, nor did I see more of the service that night. But I was not disappointed. I had seen enough to ignite my imagination, and when the Mass was finished, I filed along behind my mother and the other pilgrims as we descended the hill, feeling as though I had taken part in something distinctly separate from the time and space in which I was accustomed to living. It is common among the old that they should dwell in the past. Our lives become so ephemeral as we age, our minds nothing more than drafty, crumbling houses, ruins of their once sturdy selves. Yet it's not purely senility. I am in search of absolution, even if it must be from a God I love too shallowly, too selfishly, a God I battle like a willful child. I admit I know nothing of God. My understanding is a bramble, an unpruned olive tree strangled with vine, not helped by the years I've spent wondering and praying, imagining and asking for some small clarification, some minute glimpse of the infinite, if infinite is indeed what God is. Despite my blindness, despite my stubborn heart, I petition him daily. I ask him to forgive me my trespasses, to grant me final peace. I repent. I sold Bee's presents long ago, the dresses of Parisian design, the string of pink pearls, the gold bracelet encrusted with diamonds, the lace gloves that buttoned primly at the elbow. I burned all the papers he left that would have given me access to his bank accounts in Lyon, Toulouse, Marseille, and Paris. I have never once slept in the villa he made for me, though its feather beds would offer soothing rest for my rheumatic joints and brittle bones. I have been a good Catholic, even if I have not been to Mass in almost 30 years. I have said my rosary, I have visited the sick and buried the dead, I have sheltered and fed strangers, and even ministered to prisoners, if we count our own worldly circumstances, our own minds and bodies as prisons. I have lived like a nun in a convent, tending to my daily tasks and routines, reciting my prayers, hoping against all knowledge and experience that they might be rewarded. And still, I require absolution. None of this has washed my past of lust, greed, or envy. None of it has lifted the pall cast by my selfishness. None of it has given me peace. God, this famous God, Bee's God, and always mine too, although I resist and abuse him, God asks too much of us. We must reject our very natures, become only a whisper, a breath of ourselves. We must dwindle and squeeze into the one crevice of our hearts that is humble and kind, chaste and patient, diligent and liberal with love. It is too much. We must, as the prophet says, do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly. But one slip, one misstep along the path, and we initiate an avalanche. And though we grasp at saplings and boulders, we cannot stop our somersaulting descent. Thanks. I'll stop there. Thank you. I guess we have time still for some questions. I'd be happy to take any questions or comments, if anybody has any.
Yes. What you see as the major difference in writing between an adult and this one that
I'm working on now. Actually, this book, Nina Adolescence, I think of as being for an adult audience, although it certainly is about a teenager. But I kind of, I noticed as I was reading, erred on the side of lightness. A lot of the book is heavy. It deals with some very difficult issues. And not that teenagers don't deal with those themselves. They certainly do. But so the audience I think of for that book as being more kind of 18 to 35, you know, around there. But it's certainly a very different tone and writing, you know, trying to get into the head of an adolescent versus trying to get into the head of an 80-year-old woman is a different experience. And I mean, most markedly, of course, that I, you know, have been an adolescent, whereas I have not yet been 80, at least not in this lifetime. So, so I mean, I guess that would be the major challenge, is trying to imagine, you know, what that is about. Yes.
Why did you choose to go to first-person narration?
I just kind of heard the book in first person. It's actually, this book I'm working on alternates sections between a first-person narration from Marie's point of view throughout, and then in between each chapter there are third-person sections that are depicting my, you know, the way I imagine Marie-Madeleine, Mary Magdalene's life. So there's some, it's not solely first person, but it's a good question what makes that choice for you. I mean, I just kind of heard it that way. I don't know if I can give you a better answer than that. It does, I mean, it makes for different, you know, challenges and limitations, and I had to go for a stronger voice, you know, immediately rather than a third person. You know, you have a little more distance to play with. Yeah, so, yeah.
Were you a religious youngster?
No, not really. I grew up going to church, to a UCC, United Church of Christ, Protestant Congregationalist Church in Massachusetts. But if you know the denomination, it's not, it's a very sort of liberal-minded denomination. And it certainly was present in my life. And actually, a lot of my family members have something to do with religion in some way or another. So I've kind of grown into being fascinated with it, I would say. Yeah.
I was just reading an essay by Anne Lamott. She was talking about the need for self-forgiveness for her to write, and that she kills off a lot of trees writing crafts,
mm-hmm.
and then writes a check to the Sierra Club.
Oh, yeah. Actually, when I write, with Nina Adolescence, I threw out 400 pages of my first draft, which was, you know, hard to do at the time, but I'm very glad I did. And as I'm writing The Priest Madonna, I keep a file of cuts and the file of my draft, so that, and my cuts file now is about 150 pages, I think. Maybe even a little more. And I have about 300 pages of the draft. So what's that, you know, a 1-to-2 ratio, I guess. Yeah, I love Anne Lamott. I really relied on her Bird by Bird book quite a bit when I first started writing, and have found all of her advice, or most of it anyway, to be very helpful. And she gives it with a wonderful sense of humor, too, which is really fun. Yeah. Yeah. No, I graduated college in 94, and I lived in San Francisco, and then in Maine, and then I went to Iowa. So it was, I think it was about 5 or 6, let's see, I started in 99, yeah, so 5 years afterward, yeah. Yeah.
Do you have a fixed writing routine, and did it change when you became a mother?
How did you know I was a mother? Was that in my introduction? Yes. do I look like it? it changed. Yes, it did change. Although I have always been somebody who has to be very disciplined about it, and so I try to work 4 hours a day every weekday. So in fact, it didn't really change that much. Although, you know, because my daughter goes to daycare part time, and that's when I work. So. The only thing is that I know that, you know, that's the time, and if I don't use that time, then that's it for the day. But that's my general guideline, is I try to do about 4 hours of writing a day. Yeah. No, I really didn't. Actually, Peter mentioned the textbook Finding Katahdin, which I that was my first publication, I think. Is that right? Yeah, I think that's right. If I published anything else, it was very tiny and not worth mentioning. but that was just after college, and I kind of landed that job on a fluke. I always, my first year or two working on it, I thought, you know, are they crazy that they hired me to do this job? Because I wasn't a historian, I didn't have any, you know, experience really studying history. And anyway, it turned out all right. But no, I really didn't. It was only once that was the first thing that kind of made me think, oh wow, maybe I can really do this. You know, maybe I can actually be a writer. So, yeah. Yeah.
I'll just throw that out, and if you don't like to get any, you know, similarities while you're still working on it.
Well, what's the name of the book?
I don't remember the name, but I think it's one of her recent.
Uh-huh. Well, it's funny because there are a lot of similarities thematically with the Priest Madonna and the Da Vinci Code, which of course is, that many of you may know, is a very popular book right now. And when my editor sent me a notice that was coming out, I sort of had this feeling like, oh no, you know, my whole idea has been scooped, and you know. But in fact, after reading it, I see that it's a completely different book. And but no, I mean, it's interesting to know what else is out there.
It's not the same.
Different setting, anyway. I'll look for it, thanks. Yeah.
Isn't the acceptance rate at Iowa about 5%?
I don't really know exactly what the rate is. Although I did work on the committee that read applications, so I was part of that process, and they get a lot of applications. I mean, that's the bottom line, is that I think we got, the year that I was reading them, I think we got, maybe around 800 for 25 spots. It was something like that. Maybe it was less, 600, 800, something like that. So I'm not very good at math. You can work that out. Yeah. Yeah, Bob.
Can you tell us some of the writers that inspire you?
Yeah, it's funny. I was just talking to my cousin Kate here before I came about this. That people often ask that question. It's a very good question. But I had to come with a list, because whenever that people ask that question, they just go right out of my head. So, but I'll try to do it without looking at my list. Virginia Woolf is probably my all-time favorite, actually, which might be surprising because I don't think my writing really resembles hers at all. But she was really the author who made me want to write. I just found her dazzling and just amazing in college. And André Debussy is somebody who I've read quite a bit of and think is a remarkable human being. And the way he is able to fully embrace all of his characters is really wonderful. Jane Austen is somebody I really enjoy, and Toni Morrison is also another writing mentor, I would say. there's many others, but I went to Barnard College in New York. Are you from Barnard? Oh, good. Yay. Yeah, it's a good school. It's good for writing. Yeah.
Did you have a teach that you were inspired by, so I can tell my
friends? Yes, actually. One of my teachers, Nancy Piore, she started this program called the Writing Fellows Program, which was a peer review program. And she was a wonderful teacher. She didn't teach fiction writing or creative writing, but she was just a great teacher. Yeah. Well, I bye, Kate. I majored in English and creative writing, so I did some fiction writing, but it wasn't very good. Yeah. Any questions? Okay, thank you so much for coming.